The U.S. dollar has lost 85% of its value since the 70s, when the dollar decoupled from gold, and the government seems bent on continuing the tradition. Charlie Kirk here. From now until after the elections, the government can print as much money as they want. The last time they did that, inflation went up 9%. Gold is the only asset that has proven to withstand inflation. Invest in gold with Noble Gold Investments. You will get a 24-karat, 1/4 ounce gold standard coin for free. Just use promo code Kirk. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com. That's noblegoldinvestments.com, the only gold company I trust. Hey, everybody. Happy Saturday. Thought crime episode. I just have to warn you, the topics here, the language is spicier than your typical Charlie Kirk show. So for the homeschoolers out there, just know about that and be aware. As always, you can email us, freedom@charliekirk.com. We have Saurabh Sharma, Blake Neff, Jack Posobiec. We also talk about not drinking. So there's a lot of virtuous conversation here on this program. I think alcohol is largely a poison. Email us as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. That's freedom@charliekirk.com. Subscribe to our podcast and get involved with Turning Point USA at tpusa.com. That is tpusa.com. Consider becoming a member. It's members.charliekirk.com. At members.charliekirk.com, you get content with no ads. You also get exclusive ways to contact me and so much more that is happening, including exclusive interviews with Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, and more. Members.charliekirk.com. And subscribe to our podcast and get your friends to do the same. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Okay, it's Thursday, and we are not yet in federal prison. Welcome, everybody.
They'll get us eventually.
We have Blake Neff here, Saurabh Sharma. Did I say that right?
You did.
Who is our guest today. And then Jack Posobiec, still learning who he is. Jack, how you doing?
I'm really excited that Vivek Jr. was able to join the show today.
No. I'm Sagar and Jetty, a different person.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I think you're mildly
No, I'm the editor of National Review, actually. Ramesh Panuru.
Oh, okay.
Are you real? No. You guys are all the same person.
Have you ever
been in the room together?
Yeah. Are you guys getting sick of all these Indians in American politics now?
It's just about time.
It's only going to get worse.
You've already taken all the tech jobs.
They're here, so it's just a matter of time. Do the needful for American politics. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. This whole green card.
Jobs that Americans simply won't do, being a nativist.
Are you 100% Indian? Is that right?
Absolutely.
Well, welcome. All right. So what is our first? By the way, who is this guy next to me?
It had to go, Charlie, after last week's deep web reveal kind of blew up in my face.
Like, yeah. So Blake does this deep web reveal about some sort of bearded cringe guy. And I was like, Blake, that's a picture of you. We got to bring it back.
We're moving on to the first topic right away.
And it was one of the great backfires. I'm so glad I did it. By the way, most deep web reveals are a chance to mercilessly mock me, right? That's kind of the whole idea, is because I don't really do the internet thing. There was Blake old. And Blake 2.0, how much better does he look, everybody, right?
Just so you know, that's not a meme. That's just a picture of Blake from last week.
Though that's what I thought. I thought it was like some sort of AI generated, you know, dear ChatGPT, please construct me looking as if I haven't slept in a couple days. And but now
wait,
Blake
wait,
Shea,
Charlie, only a couple?
Charlie, what would you? We got to rate Blake's looks now. So what do we think? Beard, oh, no dear. Beard?
Well, in the non-gayest way possible, I think Blake looks great.
Okay, what about in the gayest way possible?
I was gonna say the same thing. The only thing I would say is, Blake, you should have gone. You should have picked the whole head, man. Picked the entire dome.
I was running out of time. I am team no beard.
By the way, we are taking active applications. If you want to become Blake's wife, freedom@charliekirk.com. He went to Dartmouth. He has an IQ so high you can't count to that number. freedom@charliekirk.com.
Might be Asian.
That's right. Yeah, I know, Blake. We have to do a 23andMe genetics test.
I've already done it. I'm like 100% German.
So you gave your DNA to the CIA.
Yeah, exactly. Mormons. Which one? The ancestry is the Mormons.
Yeah, they'll go and like baptize
you. You pesky Mormons, Carol, always collecting our data. It's something else. All right. What is our first topic?
Our first topic is, of course, like, we sometimes try to stay away from the breaking news, but this week you just have to. It's Fanny's Fulton Funhouse.
Big Fanny Willis.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the fourth and maybe final indictment of Trump. I mean, who knows? We'll probably get infinity of them. But we got the fourth indictment of the four they were hyping up all year, came down from Fulton County. It's probably the most far-reaching of the four. We've got 18 associates of Donald Trump all charged with crimes. They're charged as part of a RICO act. So,
oh, is it RICO or RICO?
It's RICO.
Who cares? I don't care.
Well, so this is all, is it Fannie or is it Fonny? Is it RICO? Is it RICO?
Being 100% German, I don't know how to say these.
Kiev
Italian,
or Kiev?
It's Kiev. That's definitively.
Oh, see. Okay. So you are big into pronunciations.
Well, it matters with Kiev because Kiev is a psyop by the globalists. Whereas.
So her name is Fanny.
Who are mainly
this is
German.
Actually a major
no,
point.
No, we're not giving in on this point either.
It's Big Fanny Willis.
Yeah. Big Fanny Willis. Big Fanny. Yeah. We're in full agreement on this one.
That's right. We're drawing
anyway,
the line.
Yeah. Anyway, Fanny Willis is
her big booty of charges.
Her big
booty.
You got to be Big Fanny, Jack. You can't cross the line. All right. Come on. What do you think this is?
So Fanny's pack of charges here has it's 19 total people, including Trump. And, you know, she alleges this big sweeping national conspiracy, you know, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, it's all roped in. And, you know, the conspiratorial acts include asking for phone numbers.
That's right. Mark Meadows asked Scott Perry for a phone number.
He asked for a phone number, and that was part of a national conspiracy.
I love how they had to repeat it as if for emphasis in the indictment, and this was a furtherance of the conspiracy.
Exactly, everything. And then, you know, Trump tweeted about watching OAN, and that was part of the conspiracy. He was watching a legislative hearing on OAN. It's, you know, maybe he could have watched normal OAN, but watching it with the hearing in, you know, it's not colluding.
I have to pause. Jack, you've heard of OAN before, right?
I was at OAN when Trump tweeted that people should watch OAN. And no, I wasn't. I have to go back and check, but I don't think I was actually covering that specific, you know, shift when he, you know, said to do it. I don't know if I was on. But that being said, you know, the way OAN worked is sometimes you'd record packages or like little clips that they would run throughout the day. So it's very possible that Trump has been indicted for telling people to watch me on TV. Amazing.
Really, yeah, if that really was amazing. The case.
Amazing moment in history of Poso.
Are you an unindicted co-conspirator, Jack Posobiec? Is there something you want to tell us?
I think it's a mild miracle he's not already in jail.
Oh, yeah. Right? Like I came up in the Mueller investigation. I'm in like the first section of that. I'm on like every other hit list under the sun. I feel like I haven't been trying hard enough, to be honest. The Gen 6 committee was playing my video over and over. I'm not even a co-conspirator. Like, been lazy, guys. What can I say? A couple years off, had kids. I don't know, grew a beard.
He's losing his touch.
Now, losing the touch. Really losing the touch.
So Rob, I kind of wrote this as an over-the-top exaggerated question, but in a weird way, it's really true. Like, is this, like, it's an attempt to basically scuttle a presidential candidate. It's very direct attack on First Amendment rights of speech and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, which is usually not in much dispute in America. So like, where does this rank as like an act of aggression against the American constitutional system?
It's basically just low IQ political warfare. I lived in Fulton County for like 6 years, and it's one of these classic upper middle class, you know, centrist suburbs that probably the second this woman got on the ballot thought that she was the greatest thing since sliced bread. This is the state that keeps giving you Stacey Abrams, and this is why we have to deal with Miss Fannie Willis. Democrats have dozens and dozens and dozens of these people across the country, sort of basically lawfare activists in district attorney's offices whose job it is to harass their political opponents. And you see it in states that you don't expect. You see it in red states most of all, especially red states with urban areas. And this woman is, to be entirely clear, a dyed-in-the-wool activist. Her degree is from Howard University.
That's an HBCU, right?
Yeah, known for creating.
They let Kamala in.
Yeah, known for creating many truly, truly excellent prosecutors. And her dad was a Black Panther. And she has basically made it clear that her entire goal in office is to go after the enemies of the Democratic Party. And this rushed low IQ indictment is the biggest proof of it.
Yeah, when I think of legal excellence, I think of HBCUs.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is like the Spirit Airlines of indictments, the DMV of indictments. I mean, you could go down the list. It's really endless. But
the
when
BET
I think
Image Awards of indictments,
yes, exactly. But when I think of when I read Norm Eisen's report, his op-ed this morning in New York Times, because I've learned that the way to find what the left is doing is just read whatever Norm Eisen is saying, because he's got an IQ that's like 2 points ahead of the rest of him. So he's like 117, and they he's sitting there going in the New York Times, and he's just talking about how much he loves this indictment, and it's great because it charged everybody, and they have these really novel legal theories. It's so insane. And he's looking at this thing, and he's like, wow, Norm Eisen is just eyeing up Fannie Willis's big booty of charges and saying, I love this. He can't talk about anything else. The real question that I have left is, can she back it up in court? That is,
can she back that up? Yeah, she has to, because we need, you know, reality converges on what's funny. That's one of the reasons Trump became president. And so we are hurtling towards this reality that needs to come into existence, which is Fannie Willis needs to run for Senate or governor of Georgia, because when she runs, we'll be able to get Fannie Pack. And it just needs to happen. That reality needs to come into existence. And so that makes me worry, because I feel like in that case, we do need – this case is going to have to get along far enough that she'll be able to run for Senate. So like the laws of reality ordain that this case will be with us for a while.
How funny would it be if Fannie Willis becomes like a statewide elected official in Georgia before Stacey Abrams?
That would also be really funny. Crap, she's going to be the next governor of Georgia, isn't she? Like, yes. It's too funny to not happen. Rule of funny. We're screwed. This stinks.
So apparently,
say the clip. I think we do have a clip, because like she can't read. Like, she literally can't read.
Ooh, I haven't seen this.
Well, so I don't know if we have that clip, but I do want to make sure everyone is clear, because I was educated on Georgia politics today by Colton Moore, who is doing his job as a state representative. Apparently, there is a RICO case also pending against Young Thug and Young Blood.
Yeah, was it Young Blood? Something like
it
that.
It was, yeah. Young Blood. Thug?
Yeah, Young Blood. Young Thug
young
was
thug,
one.
Young Thug Blood.
Something like that. Anyway, yeah. Well, what's great about it is it's also a RICO, I don't care, case. And it's like the largest trial in Georgia history. Like, it's jury selection's been going on for months, or I think almost a year even.
But these are actual crimes,
and
right?
Yeah, you know, actual stuff is involved. And it's expected, like, the trial itself will go on for months. And that's what's really fascinating with this indictment, is why they went after 18 people. It's not just a matter of, like, oh, we have to get everyone in Trump's orbit, though it is that. It's also that they, like, simply by trying all of these, you know, nearly two dozen people together all at once, they guarantee that this trial just goes on and on and on. And to the extent that this is all partly about 2024, they make Trump be kind of stuck in court, or at least obsessed with court happenings, for months on end instead of, you know, campaigning for the White House.
Partly about 2024.
The whole thing is. Okay, so yeah. Let's play a piece of tape here. Is this one where Fannie is struggling to read? Okay.
They're all Fannie struggling to read.
Yeah, play cut 96.
The grand jury issued arrest warrants for those who are charged. I am giving the defendants the opportunity to voluntarily surrender no later than noon.
It's very
Wakanda
important.
Wakanda forever.
Hmm?
Wakanda forever. That's what that sounds like. She might as well.
So, Rob, you can get away with the most commentary here. Well, what do your passions tell you?
Part of the reason I find her so funny is because she's part of this class of people that are trying to basically bring Wakanda forever into American politics. So, like, she's been profiled before in Time magazine, and in it she was talking about how her name is very Afrocentric, and that, you know, her middle name, which is Taifa, and I believe her first name as well, are Swahili. So there's a lot of weird psychological stuff going on here, and I don't have a hard time blaming her, because English isn't her first language. Wakandan is, so it's understandable.
I didn't realize you guys had the same middle name.
CBD does not have THC. We went through a lot of different
vetting, go to the CBD distillery that we trust, cbddistillery.com. If you need better sleep, 90% of customers report better sleep with CBD. Stop using all these pharmacological agents and all that stuff. Suffering with pain after exercise, 80% report less pain after physical activity. Enjoy better focus and concentration. Full range of carefully formulated CBD and other plant-based solutions. Packed with whole body healing, plant compounds, and vital nutrients. 100% clean ingredients. Recommended by Dr. Kevin Free, Mayo Clinic trained internist and preventative health specialist. Over 2 million satisfied customers. If you're frustrated with a health concern that is not getting better, try CBD from the source that I trust. That is cbddistillery.com. That's cbddistillery.com. Promo code Kirk. Check it out. cbddistillery.com for 20% off. Check it out right now.
Okay, I'm told we have to back it up. That's what I'm told. All right, let's play cut 90.
That I am told, this is hearsay, but I am told by a reliable source that Friday evening, somebody from Washington called the district attorney in Atlanta and said, you have to indict on Monday. We have to cover up all of the mistakes we just made with Weiss. And she said, apparently, my jurors aren't coming back till Tuesday. And they said, you didn't hear me. You have to indict on Monday. And she said, well, they're not going to get here before noon. They said, it doesn't matter. She said, this means it's going to be 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock at night. They said, it doesn't matter. We need the news
so
media
who,
shifting.
Who made that phone call?
We don't know. And I'm telling you up front, this is hearsay, but it's from a person who has remarkably good sources.
I totally believe it, though, because that would explain why they leaked and they messed up on the clerk document, why she was exhausted, and why they had the 11 p.m. press conference, Mr. Speaker. Jack, take it and run.
No, I was going to say, so this is actually really important. And you know, kudos to you for the scoop earlier today on this, that we have completely forgotten about the special counsel and Hunter Biden. I don't even think conservative media, anyone on conservative media talked about the Hunter Biden case, the Hunter Biden special counsel anywhere this entire week until you and Newt brought it up. And you know what? The minute that I heard that earlier today when I saw this clip when I was watching your show, that it just hit me. This is exactly why they did it. It's why they rushed it through. Because, Charlie, you remember, and we try to plan our show out the same way you do. We know that, okay, the grand jury is going to be meeting. They just set down a new one. They expire at the end of August, so they've got a couple more weeks. Charges, you know, we've been hearing through our sources. We were told midweek. But then all of a sudden they come Monday, and, oh, by the way, they're making mistakes. They got this clerk down in Fulton County. I thought, oh, we're going to have another pipe explosion. No, it wasn't a pipe explosion. She said she hit send instead of hitting save when she was typing up the document, because it turns out that they already knew the charges before the jury even finished. Then the judge holds everyone until midnight, acts like it's totally normal, acts like it's just normal course of business. Oh, we're just, you know, we're just doing, going through the motions down here in Fulton County like we would for anybody else. None of them ever steps back and says, this is completely insane. This is like indicting an entire football team all at once. Why is the urgency? What's the point of this? It's all about the news cycle. It's all about the news cycle. We have Evita Duffy from The Federalist on, and this has been her thesis from the start, that they keep doing this over and over. Something bad happens to Hunter, you indict Trump. And I hadn't actually connected these two because it had happened on Friday. I think Newt is 100% right.
Blake. So stepping back in the bigger picture is sort of the debate here is that's really been going on even before any charges were brought, which is the entire prosecution of Trump from all these angles, you know, Bragg, DC, Fulton County, even the, you know, civil cases out of New York, is it at all like centrally planned or coordinated? Whether this specific version is true or not, like, is there some brain trust, whether it's one person or 10 people or 50 people, where they really at some point strategize, like, okay, we're going to want to roll out these indictments so they're not simultaneous, so that all of our trials are spaced out over the course of 2024 to, you know, maximize the distraction power and really, like, you know, make sure we get the most out of this pot as possible by all working together. And is that what's taking place? And I go back and forth. It does seem like the reaction to Alvin Bragg's one was so muted. I could buy it as the DOJ and Fulton County were in full collusion. And then Alvin Bragg, like, comes in like Fat Albert and is like, hey, I got an indictment. And
blew the whole thing up and they all got really annoyed at him?
I believe this is centralized. Somebody is harmonizing and conducting this. Yeah. And I think the evidence was, let's have the weakest indictment with the craziest prosecutor go first, which was Alvin Bragg, move the Overton window to pave the way, right? He's the fullback of the indictments so that he could block the linebacker in, you know, to use the football analogy, so that then Jack Smith can then follow through, right? Because it went Alvin Bragg, documents, January 6th, Fannie Willis. Yes, sir.
This is also the indictment designed to make all of the past indictments easier. The wide sweep that they've done with almost anyone who's even tangentially provided the former president legal help over the last few years is designed to send a very clear message. If you give legal services to President Trump to help him with any of these other cases, being a presidential nominee, being a general election candidate, being involved in helping defend him in court at all, you will be attacked.
Yes.
Your families will be hurt.
That's right.
There will be protesters in front of your door every single day. There will be nails in your driveway. You will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. None of that is me inventing anything. That's just what I've heard of what one lawyer is experiencing, mm-hmm. John Eastman, and how his family's been harassed. You have decent, normal, patriotic, frankly, dorky academic lawyers who just were providing the president legal counsel and advice who have been swept up in this. And the process is the punishment. None of these people are independently wealthy, and it's designed to draw away resources, time, and energy that could be devoted to actually implementing a future conservative administration's agenda or providing the Republican nominee adequate legal representation during what every election is going to be moving forward, which is a contested one. There's always a trillion mm-hmm. lawsuits that fly left and right in any presidential election, and this is designed to make sure that the president does not have good legal representation next time.
Yeah, I mean, I know a top-tier lawyer that was reached out to by the Trump team, top-tier, former DOJ guy, and I spoke to him off the record about a month and a half ago. I said, hey, I think you'd be great. I mean, he would really help the Trump team. He'd be amazing. And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do it. I was like, why? He's like, look, I like Trump. He's like, there's some things I really don't like about him. He's like, the money would be good. He's like, but I would get in bar complaints and my reputation would be destroyed. And he's like, it's just not for me. Like, that's a real thing. I mean, what they've done to really isolate Donald Trump, and I mean, I don't want to say any in particular, but if you talk to any sophisticated lawyer, I don't know a ton, but I know enough to be dangerous. Donald Trump's team is made fun of constantly. Is that fair to say, Blake? Like, in serious legal minds, they're like, a better legal team could crush these indictments. Like, if you had 10 out of 10 lawyers, you could come in and you could countersue and you'd be taken seriously. That's an interesting thing I want to explore, Blake. One of the reasons why Donald Trump is in such legal jeopardy is because he does not have the highest quality legal counsel. Is that fair?
It's very fair. And, you know, it's a mix of this really intense aggression. I think one big episode in 2020 was, I can't remember the firm off the top of my head, but they did retain, you know, one of the elite white shoe firms for some of their election cases. And the backlash was so intense. The firm comes out and announces, we're not going to do any more, you know, cases contesting an election from here on out. And of course, I imagine they'll be perfectly happy to do so if the DNC pays them to do it in 24 or 28. And, you know, so that really active aggression, all these bar complaints, and even it's one of the less commented on parts of the Fulton case is part of the conspiracy claim. And I think actually it's one of the direct charges, one of the like false statements, is they just straight up say like, you know, these attorneys for Trump filed a legal case that made false statements.
Yes.
You know, any lawsuit is going to involve two competing versions of the truth. We don't traditionally, you know, sacrifice the losers like they're a losing Mesoamerican ball sport team. But now apparently we do if they're related to Trump. And they're really sending the message of if you're a lawyer and anywhere in the orbit, anywhere in the universe of, you know, the Trump world, like you're just not going to have a career ever again.
So Jack, let's build this out. You and I both know several of the people involved in this, you know, Rudy Giuliani, sure. John Eastman, and they will tell you privately and publicly that they have to be told, they're told no 40 times before they find a lawyer. And the blue chip law firms want nothing to do. So I'll just give you an example, right? So Andrew Gillum was indicted by the federal government on all sorts of different types of stuff. Mark Elias came in and represented him, who is a great lawyer, and he had a great supporting cast. and Andrew Gillum beat the charges. And the DOJ is probably not going to retry them. And so you can win, especially when it's political and it depends on the venue. But there's this thing called the 65 Project, which is a bipartisan effort to make sure that Donald Trump or anyone around Donald Trump does not have legal representation. This is the Barry lead here, Jack. They have awful indictments on top of lawyers that they're not as good as gets. And now this is interesting because I'll just finish the point. The audience might say, how big of a difference is a good lawyer, a bad lawyer? As someone who's been around for 11 years, it makes a whole difference. Okay. It's like the whole ball game. I mean, if you've ever fought the government or had to ever contest anything, the quality of a lawyer is everything. Jack Posobiec.
Here, real quick, you can bring up the 65 Project website here just so they can see.
Jack.
I want to say something. So I've sat through all of the so-called Trump indictment that have gone to trial in Washington, D.C. that have led to this. And when I say the Trump indictment, I mean the indictments of everyone who's been in the Trump bit. Going back to Paul Manafort, I sat through the Paul Manafort case. It goes 2018. I sat through Flynn's hearings. Stone. His didn't actually go to trial. Roger Stone, Steve Bannon. I was at the George Papadopoulos hearings. Probably a bunch that I'm not even thinking of at this point, because who can even keep track of that crap? And the point is that I've seen lawyers who seem like they're absolutely fantastic, who really bring things that are totally just well put together, well structured. They've got the, because people don't understand that you've got to do a ton of work just to show up in court. It's not a movie. This isn't the Lincoln lawyer where you can just like operate out of the backseat of your car and go in and win cases against the government. It's not like that. Okay. And, you know, with all apologies to Michael Connelly, who I'm a huge fan of his work, that in the Fed, when you're going up against the federal government that has literally unlimited resources, and, you know, you sort of got the federal government junior in the case of New York District as well as Fulton County here, because you know that they're all, and they basically all said publicly at this point that they're all sharing information. So Fannie Willis is getting information from Jack Smith, and they're all polluting.
So, Jack, I got to interrupt you. We have some, yes, go ahead, finish your thought, then we have some breaking news.
I'm just going to say I've seen both, and when you're on the wrong side of a bad lawyer, it's like, just plead guilty. Like, maybe you'll get a better sentence out of it. I don't know.
So, breaking news, as if the DOJ is not completely compromised, judges and all, breaking in the last couple seconds. Federal judge in Delaware has now dismissed without prejudice for venue reasons the tax charges against Hunter Biden.
So it might not be as bad as it looks. It looks like this is a motion from
Blake,
the
union. It looks bad.
Of course it looks bad.
Okay.
It's a motion from the United States, and it states the United States has moved, quote, to voluntarily dismiss the information filed in the above captioned matter without prejudice. That means it can be brought again. So that the United States can bring tax charges in a district where venue lies. Venue is where you're charging a person. So the immediate reading might be that they just plan to charge Hunter with tax violations in a different
but
jurisdiction.
But why did they file it in Delaware then originally?
I don't know.
Was his residence? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know enough about this case.
You typically have to file it in the place where the crime took place. But go ahead, Jack.
I think the reason that it started in Delaware was because Barr had initially assigned it there. This is where Weiss came from, that who at the time was the U.S. attorney for Delaware, that specific district. And now he has been made a special counsel, because this all came to a head when that sweetheart plea deal was completely blown up in court. And essentially the judge said, well, no, this doesn't cover future charges. So, Blake, to your point about prejudice being very important as to whether or not the charges can be rebrought in another district or even that district. What's really going on here is jurisdiction shopping and judge shopping, because a special counsel has the ability to bring these in different areas. This was actually, by the way, one of the things that the IRS whistleblowers brought up way back when we had those hearings, was because the fact that they wanted Weiss to be a special counsel because they thought it would be about bringing more charges against Hunter. Now it turns out that it's not about that. It's about taking this sweetheart deal and bringing it to either a jurisdiction or a different judge that will, you know, basically rubber stamp.
Yeah, this is bad. We'll see. But so then, therefore, Blake, it will take the DOJ to refile charges in a different venue.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where that would be.
Probably DC, if anywhere.
It could be DC. It could be New York. It could be any. I mean, it could even be that they decide you were living in California when you did it. He does have a good hat. I remember looking this up when I was trying to see if we could charge Hunter in any random place, and he does unfortunately have a habit of committing his crimes in blue states,
almost intentionally. Maybe he received a wire when he was in Arkansas. Don't hold your breath, though. Anyway, that was some breaking news here. Right, what is the? We'll keep our eyes on that. So, Rob, do you have any comments on any of this?
I just think it's worth comparing the quality of legal representation that Hunter Biden gets and that the president gets.
Riff on that. Yeah.
The worst thing that's going on in the legal profession right now for the right of center is that if you are someone at the top of your profession, you're a partner at one of these big firms, whether it's Sullivan and Cromwell or Paul Weiss or Cooper and Kirk or Jones Day, whatever it might be, on the left of center, the left of center partners could represent the worst, most heinous, rapist, terrorist, pedophile the world has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And they will get showered with legal accolades and glory for being part of ensuring that we have a proper system of justice in this country. In fact, they were all through the 2000s and early 2010s. You would see these lawyers who were getting paid millions and millions of dollars at their firm get awarded plenty of time to do pro bono hours to support the people who blew up the Twin Towers, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, if you are someone who is a lawyer, and let's be honest, most lawyers are risk-averse people who went into that profession for its stability and consistency, it has been made very clear to you that you cannot be involved on the right of center.
That's correct.
But if it's to defend the basket case son of the former president, if anything, it is a career bonus.
No, I mean, let's even be more specific. Ted Kaczynski received better legal help than Donald Trump will.
I mean, your average BLM store looter got better legal health than Trump did. They're all getting like $1 million payouts from New York City now.
No doubt.
Your average illegal alien gets better legal representation than Donald Trump does because of the nonprofits on the border.
That's right, Jack.
When I was at Guantanamo Bay, so this came up frequently where we would have lawyers traveling down to meet with their defendants who were the detainees. These were some of the most high-powered lawyers. They were making cases out of it. Some of the ones who have been released have gone on to write books. Jordan Peterson interviewed this one just absolute fabulous storyteller detainee who got out and just made up a ton of stuff in his book and was able to be out there. And these were people, and the media would repeat everything they said about brands in the toilet and sharing Harry Potter books. And actually, they did read Harry Potter books, but Twilight books was a big lie that they spread at one point. And so I remember seeing this going like, did these guys know what these people are here for? Like, they're totally cool with that. Like, and I get, yeah, everybody deserves a defense. I get that. But really made me ask that question. And okay, I say, all right, everyone, you know, deserves a defense. But then you realize that for a lot of these lawyers, it's about getting a career by saying, oh, I beat the U.S. government. And now we're at a point where I think I just saw earlier today that there's a plea deal in the works for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some of the other actual planners of 9/11, so that they would be spared the death penalty.
Amazing. It's incredible. Okay, let's get an ad in here. Field of Greens. Who has that? Jack, is that you?
Yeah. Let me give you 2 seconds because I've just been eating my Field of Greens so much. But I wanna paint a picture for everyone. Okay. Imagine you're at your doctor's office. Your doctor glances up from your chart and they say, hey, whatever you're doing, I want you to keep it up. That is the Field of Greens better health promise. Got a customer testimonial in. One customer said, I've been taking Field of Greens and this is the second time my doctor has danced into the room praising my blood result. Credit where credit's due, thanks to Field of Greens. Each fruit and vegetable in Field of Greens was medically selected from a specific health benefit. Some support vital organs like heart, lungs, kidney. Others support metabolism for healthy energy and weight loss. If you're busy, don't get enough exercise, and you eat too much fast food, take Field of Greens. Look, Field of Greens can't promise that your doctor will be literally dancing into your room at your next appointment, but they can promise that at that next checkup, your doctor will notice your improved health. You get your money back. I trust Field of Greens for my health. You can too. Let me get you started with 15% off. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code POSO. That's promo code POSO at fieldofgreens.com.
What's that promo code he reads at the end of the ad every time?
Promo code POSO, the most powerful promo code on the face of the...
Now, somebody just played $20 on Rumble Rants. They said, I'm chipping in $20 for extra batteries for the smoke alarms.
Smoke alarms? What do you mean? What's the smoke alarm thing?
I mean, I think someone made a certain funny video of Fannie Willis speaking with the fire alarm going off. Wouldn't know.
I thought that was Joy Roy Reed's living room.
I didn't notice that. I mean, yeah. Can we play that clip again? Because I didn't notice that.
The grand jury issued arrest warrants for those who are charged. I am giving the defendants the opportunity to voluntarily surrender no later than noon.
Okay, Maui.
Maui, all right.
Yeah, so, I don't hear it in the clip, by the way. I think that's the wrong clip.
Uh-oh. Well, so Maui had a tragic fire this past week. It's very bad. It's 111 confirmed dead last I checked, and there's like 1,000 people still missing. So we could end up in a situation where this is like a 9/11 level catastrophe. So very tragic. We're very respectful of that. But obviously, any disaster gets immediately politicized in often disturbing ways. And so naturally, the one that comes to mind with any natural disaster is global warming was related to it somehow. So a lot of people claimed this. The governor of Hawaii said that climate change was driving this because it caused the fire hurricane to take place. Even ABC News was unimpressed by that. They did a little article that said fire hurricanes aren't real, but they still asserted that. But what's becoming more worrisome is it seems that whatever the natural causes of the fire, it was definitely exacerbated by what seems to be ideology and incompetence within Maui's government. So first of all, the chief emergency management officer of Maui, Herman Endaya, is a guy with a law degree and a political science degree. Mm-hmm. And as a guy who has a political science degree, they're not impressive. And
even from Dartmouth,
and they call it a government.
You went to some school. You went to UT, right?
I did. I went to state school. Yeah. Not as fancy as Mr. Neff here.
At Dartmouth, they call it a government degree, which kind of obscures how stupid they are. But they are still stupid.
They do that at UT also.
You ruling class people with your pieces of paper.
It's ghastly. It's ghastly. Anyway, he has a political science degree and a law degree, and then he somehow is Maui's emergency manager. He assured us that he watched many online FEMA trainings and workshops. And so he was the guy in charge of their big emergency response. He's the guy who made the call to not, you know, sound their the sirens. Warning sirens.
Which, in all fairness, I could see he both sides of the argument. I've heard from locals he's not totally off.
There's an argument both ways, so we won't drag him too much for that, but there's probably other stuff we don't know about. The other big thing is their water resources division.
Yeah, this went viral.
Yes. So we have the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources. You know, they have limited water in Hawaii. They have to manage it a bit. And as these fires are breaking out, these landowners are begging the land department, hey, can we take some of the water that we have, you know, stockpiled and use it to fight this fire? And the state water official in question that they spoke to, according to local media reporting on this, was a guy, M. Kaleo Manuel. He has a degree in Hawaiian studies, and he has very interesting ideas about water. Which do we still have that clip available? I think it was clip 80.
Oh yeah, no, these are pagan earth worshippers. Play cut 80.
The commission is responsible per our authorizing statute to protect and manage all water resources in the state. One water is like taking it, looking at it from a holistic system perspective, you know, and in essence, we treated it, Native Hawaiians treated water as one of the earthly manifestations of a god in a kua kane. We've become used to looking at water as like something which we use and not necessarily something that we revere as that thing that gives us life, right? I mean, to me, it's a shift in value set. So really, my motto is always like, let water connect us and not divide us. Like we can share it, but it requires true conversations about equity.
Yeah, that's just a bunch of pagan crap.
Now we highlighted this. This guy highlighted on Media Matters. You can bring it up on the laptop.
Yeah, no, because I went all out.
Yeah, just went like, okay, this guy is saying like, you know, water is a manifestation of the deity and we need to revere the water, not use the water. And, you know, he revered the water all the way until 106 people died, it turns out, because he turned down the request for the water
And then this fire ended up exploding out of control, killing a ton of people. And it doesn't even stop there. The Hawaiian Electric, the local power company, they've known for years that they have these invasive grasses that are growing all over Hawaii. They're very much a fire hazard. And everyone kind of knows about it. They've been having years of warnings like this is going to burn up. And they're growing a lot around our electric wires, which spark and will cause fires. And over the last few years, Hawaiian Electric spent a grand total of maybe like $225,000 on fire mitigation. And they spent a lot more than that on what Hawaii really cares about, which is they're one of the first states to pass a decree that all electricity has to be renewable by, you know, some distant date in the future. I think 2045 in Hawaii's case. Mm-hmm. And so they spent a lot of money on that because the Hawaiian lawmakers are very concerned with that. And the good news for them is they're apparently going to need a lot less electrical power now because they have screwed up massively enough that they burned down much of the island of Maui.
Yeah, I mean, this feels like government incompetency and ideology. So, Rob, your reaction.
This is what it's like to live in a country that is getting worse. You know, we had 50 years of highly competent young men who served in a couple of wars who came back to the country and just wanted to have a middle-class income and help maintain our basic infrastructure, whether it was our electricity, our sewage, our cities, towns, etc. Now those people are retiring and they're passing away and they're being replaced by people like that very fruity sounding gentleman we just heard from. And everything is going to get much, much worse. Fruity. It's going to get slower. It's going to get less consistent. And the task of building Western civilization becomes impossible when you have incompetent people like this running around. The ideologization of energy, it can sound like a normie Republican issue at some point, but it is actually a big problem because without stable, consistent energy, none of this works. Human civilization is not possible, certainly not on a tiny island, a six-hour flight away from the mainland continent. If anything, I'd be much more precious if I was Hawaii with having really competent infrastructure in place. I'm sure it's possible to attract really high-quality engineers. They can get a nice house on the beach, whatever. Mm-hmm. Put the competent guys in charge of that as opposed to dumb ideologues who majored in Hawaiian studies.
It's very much going under the radar. But for example, I just brought up an article because I remembered reading it. And in the 12 years from 2012 to 2022, power outages went up 64% in the United States. Our population did not go up 64%. The power outages did.
Style, baby.
Yeah, and it's just, it's not super bad yet. Like most of us do not, you know, we're not in South Africa where it's out 8 hours a day or more. But there is like, you know, we used to be able to take for granted that certain services would just impeccably run, like just perfectly. It was a freak incident if the lights went out. And now it's just here and there, there's problems. And a lot of things are running on these like old boomers and Gen X types who are just highly capable of fading out.
So there's something, and you're familiar with this, Saurabh, because you've run in some of these circles. Jack, you've heard this. What is it? Eric Weinstein, not Brett Weinstein, has a thing called the ego, the embedded growth obligation. You've heard this, Saurabh?
Definitely.
Yeah, it's in a lot of those kind of like new right circles. And I think it's actually really smart, which is a lot of boomers had the ego, which is that everything just automatically gets better because we're in America. And it's almost Hegelian in some ways, actually, that kind of like arc of history. And eventually it's just going to keep getting better. But Jack, that's actually not a guarantee.
It's like thesis, power, yes, antithesis, darkness.
And we mash it together. And the synthesis is South Africa, rolling blackouts, Maui and trans kids. So Jack, Rob makes the smartest point here, which I think I want to explore, which is it's actually really hard for some of our older listeners, not hard, but I have to fight to kind of get this to be to a place of agreement. And I think, Saurabh, you know what I'm going to say, which is people don't like to hear that the country's actually getting worse. Jack Posobiec.
Well, so I'll bring up two things. One, just to go back to what you said about water, that I don't know if a lot of people have seen this. I retweeted it earlier because Tulsi Gabbard is there. Now, she represented Maui in Congress. She was there for term, so 8 years. Maui was always, I don't know if it was predicted, et cetera, but basically this was her area. And she's actually on the ground. She was interviewing a guy who was saying that when he first went to fight the fire, he said, well, the fire wasn't big and it had just gotten to my backyard. So I went to grab my hose and I thought I'd put the hose on the fire to go out. Turn the hose on, hose didn't work. I think, oh my gosh, so what am I going to do? Go inside, fill up a bucket. Try to do that. Now that doesn't work. Bathtub, et cetera, doesn't work. So he says, okay, finally, I see a fire truck. Fire truck goes to the fire hydrant. we all see fire hydrants. We all have them around. We all just assume that that will work if there's a fire, right? You know, this is basic stuff that, you know, going back to, you know, Charlie, you're from Chicago. This is, has always been around, right? You know, fires have always been around. John Adams and the Great Fire of the Colony.
It did destroy the Chicagoland area, the entire Chicago.
Well, that's what I mean. This isn't a new problem.
It's a new phenomenon
that we're trying to solve here. The fire truck went to the fire hydrant, no water pressure. So the water didn't come out. Just imagine that happening in the United States in the current moment. And so what I mean to say is that, yeah, you can believe in this sort of like, you know, full on always upward trajectory of history. This, you know, art history always bending towards moral justice, kind of like Obama, MLK sort of thing.
This is German philosophic trash.
There's also a great theory out there, called the theory of the fourth turning. And you can go into older belief cycles that talk about this, and people have laid it out in different ways, but it's basically a secular view of history where basically societies, empires, civilizations have always been playing out in these cycles. And yeah, technology gets better, et cetera. But it's more so that just like we have the four seasons, essentially, that times will not always be getting better, that there will come a cycle where things get worse. And there comes a cycle where things are falling apart. And typically we've seen in the United States, these seem to happen in 80-year increments. We're now going through the parallel of the Great Depression, and we're rapidly approaching the parallel of World War II, if you go back here.
This is very similar to Ecclesiastes 3, which is the final book written by King Solomon, where it's really the first line of Ecclesiastes is King Solomon basically acting like he's like a teenager. Life is meaningless. Life is meaningless. He gets to actually, it's a lot deeper than that. But the first line in Hebrew is meaningless, meaningless. But you're right, Jack. You ever heard the song, I think the Eagles, to Everything There's a Season? Did they write that song? To Everything There Is a Season?
The birds.
Oh, is it the birds? Okay. Well, I'm not that far off. Eagles, birds, that's
they
the
both
same.
Fly.
One is a species.
They're a form of
one.
Bird.
Okay. But it says to everything there is a season and a time and purpose under heaven, a time to be born, time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck out that which is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate, a time of war, a time of peace. Nothing quite like Ecclesiastes. Remember what they took from us. This was when our country was a respectable country. Play Cut 107.
Off in the distance, the game's dragging on. There's strikes on the batter, some runners are on. Then suddenly everyone's looking at me. My mind has been wondering, what could it be? They point to the sky and I look up above, and a baseball falls into my glove. I play right field. It's important, you know. You gotta know how to catch, you gotta know how to throw. That's why I play in right field, way out where the dandelions grow.
As a proud sponsor of Little League Baseball, Pizza Hut welcomes all the kids who make it great.
Making it great.
It just the music to the joy, the joyful storytelling. You contrast that with Dylan Mulvaney.
I just,
that's what
has
first
Pizza Hut given him a deal yet?
No, but you get the point, right? I mean, Dylan Mulvaney, who obviously needs to be on very heavy psychiatric medication and out of all public life, right? Who is like promoting ads and is a sick puppy versus this beautiful anthem. Just another piece here. Let's just play Cut 109. I miss the country I grew up in. I miss this country. It was a de-radicalized country. Used to talk about family, neighbors, sports. I didn't care if my neighbors were Democrats. I have a funny story about that in a second. Play Cut 108.
Oh, Jerome, a birthday party at Pizza Hut. What fun.
You bet, Mom.
Okay, sweetie.
Have a good time.
She will.
You look so cute.
Remember to say hello to Mrs. Miller.
I will.
And don't forget everything I told you.
Okay.
Have fun. Hello, Jerome.
Hi, Mrs. Miller.
Wish Jessica a happy birthday. And remember, polite little boys always use their napkins.
We're gonna party, party right now.
Well, how do we chew?
With our mouths closed.
We're gonna party.
Don't forget to share.
Right now.
Share, share. Use your silverware. And sweetie, I don't care what the other little boys do. You keep your elbows off the table. And Jerome, please.
Goodbye, Jerome.
Be nice to the little girls. Honey, did you have a good time?
I did everything you said. I was even nice to a girl.
Oh, my little angel.
Yeah.
Okay, I have three reactions. First of all, if there were that many white kids in a commercial, you'd be thrown in a gulag, like, immediately, if that aired in
the suffocating whiteness of the Pizza
Number
Hut
two,
commercial.
Do you notice that the kind of subtext is order, manners, right? There are
white
rules for life. Exactly. No, that's white supremacists.
Bow tie, suspenders.
Keep your elbows off the table. Number three, there's no gay anything. The girl and the boy have this kind of romantic tension. That is a beautiful advertisement. Jack, you're kind of into this abstract internet culture stuff. You spend way too much time on your phone.
Yeah, go
ahead.
Pizza Hut nationalism is something that I've talked about a lot. I actually did a whole podcast with Lou Dobbs talking about Pizza Hut nationalism. Tim Pool and I talk about, you know, opening up a finding one of those like abandoned pizza shops or like getting a bunch of them like across the country. And we're gonna call it like Papa Jack's Pizza Shack. And it's so much more than just sitting down and having a meal, right? It's about the feeling that you get when you watch these videos. And I just got to say, there are times where I watch these videos and I get happy because I remember how amazing America was. But there's times where I get mad because I look at these things and I become furious about the fact that my kids, my two little boys, are growing up in a country where they can't just find this at the corner. Where, like, when I was growing up in the Philadelphia area, you could go right down to the corner and you'd see all your friends there. All your buddies from school would be there. You could go play baseball and it was all within walking distance. You could just go right in. And this, it was about a meeting place. And so, no, it's not about pizza. It's not even necessarily about Pizza Hut, but Pizza Hut understood that by tapping into that ether, that tapping into that energy, that vibe of America in the 1990s. By the way, these were the Pizza Hut commercials that used to play before the Nickelodeon VHS movies. So like, I think one was like Ninja Turtles, one was like Land Before Time. Even though that wasn't Nickelodeon, I think that was Don Bluth or whatever. And at the same time, Netflix right now, the movie on Netflix right now that they're all pushing for kids is like the two gay knights and they're transgender fluid, whatever. And it's like big, bold, you know, I didn't believe it. So, you know, somebody showed me on their Netflix account. I did not believe, I have no idea what it's called. And it's just two gay knights. And this is set up for kids. It was actually Slate Magazine actually called it.
We've got it on the screen here. Bring it up.
Too gay for Disney.
The older I get, the simpler the explanations I find for this. The left has largely just weaponized mental illness on the rest of the country. Is that unfair, Sarab?
No, not at all. And the thing that I kept on thinking as I was watching that commercial is that back then, Pizza Hut was a place that you went to with your family and your children.
That's exactly
right. And all the other people from your neighborhood. Now, the Pizza Hut advertisement you're likely to see, putting aside the ideological content, is order this extra, extra large pizza that's 1,800 to 3,000 calories that you're going to shove in your face or shove a couple in your face while you're at home, you know, doing your Zoom date because you have to put on the mask and sit inside because of COVID or whatever the other excuse they're going to come up with for shutting everyone inside.
Yeah,
now.
And also just the aesthetic of new Pizza Hut is really corporate and utilitarian, right?
A friend of mine was just there the last week and he said, like, I went there with my wife because I remember going when I was a kid in the 80s. And he was like,
it crushed me to see it. He says it was literally like going to eat at like a cubicle office.
Man.
There's one near us now, and I went in. So I had a tweet thread about this that went pretty viral, I don't know, maybe like 8 months ago or so, that really kicked off this whole Pizza Hut nationalism thing. Because I went to one that still actually was in one of the original, like it's not the corporate one that you're talking about, Blake. It was one of the older ones that, you know, had the regular Pizza Hut design, you know, that sort of like hut. I don't know what you call it, the roof. My brother's the architect, not me. And we went in, and it was after COVID, and yet the floors were filthy. It was half the place was filled with like unmade pizza boxes. There were a bunch of like DoorDash drivers and Uber Eats people just like waiting, you know, the gig slaves waiting for like to pick up their order for it to be, you know, to get ready. And then I sat down and I said, oh, I want to order a couple of wings and a personal pizza for my son here. Do you guys still do Book It? And the guy's just looking at me with like bug eyes, like he has no clue what I'm talking about or why I would even deem to like set foot in the store, all because I'm thinking, hey, it's a Pizza Hut. I can go take my kid. I remember it from when I was younger, and it took off like wildfire on the internet. No pun intended, but that it so many people saying this was absolutely something that we all shared, that we all loved, and is I think ubiquitously taken from no matter where you are in the country. This has all been taken. It's this whole idea. And so, Rob, you were hitting it a little bit too, this idea of third spaces, that third spaces don't exist.
A few things I want to hit before we move on is, one, a funny thing with the second ad is it's actually a nostalgic ad itself. Like, kids did not wear bow ties in the 1980s. He's actually basically looking like he's from Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah.
So it's 90s nostalgia for 50s sitcoms.
That's right.
And yeah, so
it's like a 70-year reversion.
Even they had a sense like, oh, yes, we've fallen. It's over. It's, you know. And also, you know, we can focus on like the Pizza Hut community aspect, but like, who actually does Little League anymore? Like, Little League teams now, even sports kind of are terrible. That,
oh, yeah. No,
you have to pay now.
I totally agree.
Childhood sports. And the essence of childhood. They do.
No, but well, hold on. The essence of childhood sports. Blake's about to make a really deep point. I'll piggyback it.
The essence of childhood sports now is, instead of, you know, pay $300 so your kid's in a league with other kids
with
in his neighborhood, with locals,
friends.
Now it's like you'll pay $4,000 to be on a travel team.
This is the point.
Travel team
exactly
to train.
I knew you were
get
going
a college
there
scholarship. Maybe long shot you can go pro. And that's what everything is
No, it is the professionalization of youth sports has destroyed social bonds. I was at the kind of beginning edge of this. I'm not that great of a basketball player, but I'm tall and, you know, I love the sport. So I was, AAU was just coming onto the scene. I don't know if you're familiar with it. AAU basketball, it has destroyed the sport, right? And the kind of AAUification of sports has gone everywhere in baseball and softball. So you'll have, I mean, I know someone really well here and they're like, yeah, you know, my 9-year-old is on a travel team and we're going to Vegas and we're going to LA. I'm like, well, who's on his team? They're like, well, someone from Wickenburg and someone from Chandler and Scottsdale. I'm like, that's not what local sports is about. Usually it's just like, oh, there's Johnny and, you know, person on the street. It's actually about, none of us are going to go play for the Oakland A's. We know that, but it's actually about character development and local bonds. Sarab.
Well, and let's think through why that happens. On the upper end of the income spectrum, it's happening because status anxious people want to make sure that their kids preserve or increase the level of status they have in society. And so, you know, if the kid isn't necessarily going to cut it to get into Dartmouth or Harvard or something, well, the second they exhibit any aptitude in baseball, they're going to spend the ages of 3 to 23 playing as much baseball as humanly possible to the point that they hate it. And if you're lower middle class or working class, it feels like the only ticket into the middle class or any prosperity for your kids, because it's not like we have a thriving blue collar economy for people who don't want to go to college. That's the only way out of poverty for so many people. So it's ruined what childhood is. Kids are expected to perform at the level of adults starting at very, very young ages. You don't get a childhood anymore unless you have parents that are trying to very intentionally give you a very different kind of life, usually through homeschooling or in some cases, some of these classical schools.
So, Sarab, you said a frame, which is class anxious, status anxious.
Yeah.
Well, what is this?
Well, it's basically the reason why every single, you know, two income, upper middle class family is utterly insane. because they're mortally terrified at the thought of their children being perceived as lower on the status hierarchy as they are. It's why people will dump tens of thousands of dollars into test prep or college prep. I went to high school in one of these suburbs in the Dallas area where basically every family that thought this way was expected to spend tens of thousands of dollars to maximize the kind of school that their kids could get into, because God forbid your son turn out to be an HVAC repairman and make more money than you probably with less debt.
I'm a class trader from where I come from, the suburbs of Chicago. I mean, it's all worked out, but originally when I said I wasn't going to college, it would have been easier to say I was a meth addict.
Yeah. And that's unfortunately the situation that so many parents find themselves in, is that the cultural milieu that they're in, their fellow peers, their parents, and in some cases, even their family members will tell them that you have failed as a parent.
That's exactly
if your kid doesn't, you know, spend $250,000 to go to the private school in the state that isn't even really churning out people who can support themselves on their income. Because again, God forbid if they become an electrician or an HVAC salesman or something like that.
It's not just that. I mean, it is to circle all the way back to, you know, the decay of, you know, basic things. It's not just loss of status, but I think a lot of people do cosmically grasp that you need to move heaven and earth to essentially marry, have 2 to 3 kids and have them grow up in the same general environment that you could just kind of automatically grow up in a 1980s suburb. Now that 1980s suburb costs, you know, the housing costs are 3 times what they were. Every single activity costs way more. You now need to save from birth to pay for a college if they want to go to college. And even the sports teams are now several thousand dollars a year. So it's, you spend 3 times as much to get a sort of creepy, uncanny valley facsimile of the life that they once had in the 1980s. And I think the desire to imitate this is what really is driving a ton of people insane.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived it. I'm not a card-carrying member of the ruling class because I didn't go to college, which in some ways I think actually is you really want to stand out. You really, like, it's not a Harvard or a Dartmouth degree. It's don't go to college. But Jack, it's...
Oliver Anthony didn't even finish high school.
Oh, the redheaded, the red beard guy. So tell us about that, Jack.
He posted something earlier today about basically telling his life story. And, you know, people had been trying to dox him and say, hey, your name's not really Oliver. Your name's Christopher. What's up with that, et cetera, et cetera. Who are you? Where you come from? It's the internet, right? So we must demand all of the information possible about someone. What are you watching? You know, they were like, why is he watching very naughty Patrick Bet David interviews on YouTube and things like this? I think he actually had a chirp video. He tweeted about it. Well, you know, how come nobody checked out the chirp video I was watching? You know, like his YouTube playlist or whatever. And he pointed out that, you know, so the guy's got number one song in the country, definitely hit a vein that, you know, I think kind of like we're talking about this sort of energy that's been out there, this emotion that's basically floating through the air.
This is really
doesn't
smart.
Doesn't go to college, basically said that he dropped out of high school when he was 17, got a GED. He's basically been working blue collar ever since then. I think he's 30, 31 now. So, you know, do the math, almost 15 years. And he just basically poured that into some music playing out in his backyard.
So, I mean, we're going to play the song in a second. I'll be honest. The song's not really for me, but I don't go out of my way to try to make somebody unsuccessful. This is a really effed up thing happening in our country. And you see it. Sarab, if you have any level of virality or success, it's we must crush you. We must dox you. We must destroy you. It's really sick. And as someone who experiences it every day, I could just like say, screw you. You know, it's been 11 years of that. But it's a real thing, isn't it, Jack? Where it's like you have any micron of breakthrough, and the incentive structure is how quickly can we crush you, Jack?
Well, look what they did to the plain lady, where she's not even making a political point, not even I think trying to go viral, and they basically they call these a human flesh mob against her, just this huge volley of the horde of people online trying to track her down. I think 4chan had her name within like 30 seconds or something. It was a, you know, pretty much the average for those guys. And
autism strikes again.
Exactly. You
the autists will save us, Sir Rob.
And
okay? Or kill us.
They literally called in a drone strike on ISIS once in Syria. And the point is, though, is that people are trying to say, okay, well, is she, you know, is she tied to the government? Is she tied to, what's she tied to? What is she part of? And she's like, she's clearly just some lady on a plane. And now she's stuck in the middle of this viral clip. And that actually is part of the problem with the incentive structure, Charlie, that you're talking about, where the United States now, I would argue that we've, you know, obviously we're far beyond the Constitution and laws. We're actually now ruled by viral videos and the characters who animate those viral videos. And so in order to try to defeat one of those viral videos, you must then either impugn the character of that person, you must find out if they're lying, you have to find out if it's been taken out of context, or you let the viral video win and you just go with it. We are now, the United States government is now viral.
Here's what it is. It's a bunch of resentful, jealous people that have miserable lives that want to see other people be destroyed. And that is largely the left. Okay, I want to tell you about Noble Gold Investments, then we're going to talk about whether or not we should ban alcohol. NobleGoldInvestments.com. Noble Gold is a great company. NobleGoldInvestments.com. If you want to secure your finances, go to NobleGoldInvestments.com. We are not an investment show. We don't give investment advice, but I buy all of my gold from Noble Gold Investments. Noble Gold Investments, they are a great company. They do a wonderful job. I think very highly of them. Colin Plume has recently been on our program to talk about the new things that they are unveiling. So write it down, reference it, go to the website, noblegoldinvestments.com, and check out their gold IRA package. The money printing is continuing. If you were to ask my own personal opinion, I do not think this market is properly priced. I think the market is hot. So we'll see what happens. Maybe I'm wrong. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com. What I am right about, though, is that there are more dollar bills out than ever before. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com. So the final time, this will probably be the final time. Oh, no, we have Deep Web Reveal because we have to go to Ron Polling. We have to.
We do.
We have two things left.
Whoa, don't get away.
Okay. I want. So Andrew comes into the chat, and usually these kind of messages are like, hey, guys, you know, just letting you know, these are some potential advertisers. And usually it's like thumbs up, sounds great, everything's terrific, whatever. And so then Andrew, and again, probably a really great company, sweet people that run it, but I was the one that led the charge. And Andrew was like, hey, here's one of them. And it was an alcohol company, right? Again, nice website, sweet people, value aligned. And I was like, yeah, I don't feel comfortable promoting alcohol. That's not going to happen. And so then it kind of 400 messages later, we are now at the place of, which is a thought crime, which is actually prohibition worked and was probably a good idea. And it's been whitewashed by the distillery companies. Blake Neff.
It's kind of weirdly true. Like if you look, if you go back,
it's true.
If you go back to, you know, what, you know, why were people deciding to ban alcohol?
That's
the
most important question.
And you look at it and it's like, if you took fentanyl and every other drug in America, all the problems caused by it, like it was all kind of condensed into one single source. So, you know, these days we have fatherless homes because of crime and because of drugs and because just people, you know, value decay. Back then, almost all of this was related to alcohol. So you would have broken homes because the dad just went and drank himself all the time. This is what caused domestic violence. Dad drinks, hits his wife, hits his kids. And it was just causing tons of crime, tons of violence. And the truth, which is not often honestly remarked upon, is, you know, once we passed prohibition, we did get rid of it 15 years later, but it actually worked. Like all the problems related to alcohol have never risen back to where they were before they did prohibition. And whether that means you'd want to ban it today, I'm not going to assert that, but it is interesting to think about.
Well, and this is what's the most important question, because the people use prohibition as like a smart guy argument. Like, oh, you want to keep weed illegal? What about prohibition? Like, calm down, Patsy. Okay. Let's actually ask the question, how bad it must have been to want to pass a constitutional amendment. There was probably a good reason for that, right, Blake? This was a country at the time that was not, you know, blitzing into constitutional amendments. So something was going on where they were saying, wait a second, we need a constitutional amendment. And so there, what was, it was actually led by women. Most people don't know that, by moms and wives that were outraged at their drunk, good for nothing, alcoholic husbands
and fathers
that were seeing a massive moral problem. By the way, there's some amazing thought crime books on prohibition. You have one of them, right, Blake?
There was one called The Alcoholic Republic, and it's not so much about prohibition, but it's about how much alcohol America drank before prohibition. And it makes your eyes water. It was something like the average American was drinking just gallons and gallons of alcohol.
Yeah, and if I were to be honest, Jack, I think that the conservative movement has an alcohol problem. Am I right, Jack Posobiec?
Well, I'll just say this from personal my personal standpoint. So I'm 17 years sober. I will hit 18 years at the end of next month. I don't think alcohol is something that provides and makes people productive. I don't think it's something that people derive value from. I think it's also something where, if anything, it just sort of degrades our culture in general, because it gets us to a place where we push alcoholism so much in this country. And it's a huge problem, by the way, in Eastern Europe, some of the other former Soviet countries, but even in the United States, where we don't have the economic issues that those areas do, we have this whole pervasive belief system where, you know, if you're going to go out, you've got to be drinking. You can't enjoy that, sporting engagement. If you're going to watch baseball, football, whatever, you got to have a drink in your hand. You can't go out and meet somebody if you're not drinking. Where do you go to meet people? You go to the bar. If you're going to have a party, well, you're not really partying if you're not drinking. And keep in mind, this is someone I went through 8 years in the Navy without having a drink. So, you know, we'd pull into port somewhere. Oh, where's everybody going? Let's go get wasted. You're not going out to have fun. You're going out for the purpose of getting wasted. Not only that, Carly, but if you look at the gender difference between who's doing more binge drinking these days, women have actually, and we talk about the wage gap, they've actually closed the binge drinking gap when it comes to men. And so, look, yeah. I see this in the conservative movement just like anybody else, you know, and you could say, as you know, in Christianity, we have the phrase, be in the world, not of the world. And I would hope that for conservatives, look, I'm not going to say you have to be a full-on teetotaler or something. I wouldn't say that I'm currently, you know, for prohibition, but I do think that we should actually talk about it honestly. And we should talk about the fact that it was actually good. It benefited the country. Like, the results of it were positive. Yeah, positive.
Well, first of all, yeah, I mean, women are closing the alcohol gap. They're also mixing with benzos and Xanax. And so we have to be honest about
that.
But
Rob,
does the right have a drinking problem?
Yeah, I'm not going to beat around the bush like Jack did. Yes, 100,000%. Exactly. I live in Washington, D.C., where functional alcoholism is present in probably over half of congressional staff. So the people advising your bosses or your representatives in Congress on how to vote on legislation, and frequently those representatives themselves are drunk as can be while they're making those choices. So at a sort of interpersonal level, I grew up watching people get trashed at every conservative conference there was. And I started in politics pretty young, and I sort of created a rule for myself that I wasn't going to drink at these public events until I was 21, if at all. And then even after that, I've tried to keep pretty temperate myself. And you just see that people end up destroying their lives drinking like crazy when they were young. And this is a civilizational problem as well. There's a very interesting line of thought that it is the overall decrease in alcohol consumption over the last few centuries that caused most of the technological and civilizational progress that we saw. The idea behind this being that before we had really good water treatment technology, the only potable water that you could carry wasn't water exactly. It was water with a little bit of extra stuff, i.e. beer and wine. And so people were rocking a day buzz basically all day, every day for millennia, basically. And as water technology got better, we started seeing people actually drink less, and that's where you got a lot of technological progress. Right around the same time, you saw the proliferation of coffee, and there's people who make the argument that the transition from alcohol, which is a depressant, to coffee, which is a stimulant, caused the Enlightenment. And yes, there's some problems with the Enlightenment, but in terms of the technological progress that makes human flourishing possible, it was certainly great. So again, I don't necessarily want to see prohibition today. I think most people who drink a lot should drink significantly less. And the statistics are pretty clear that if you drink at all, most of the people who drink at all drink way too much. And I certainly have no patience for the argument. Again, what you said, the smart guy argument, which is that, oh, teehee, we had prohibition. That didn't work out. That means you have to allow heroin to suffuse your streets because that's the enlightened thing to do. Absolutely not. Drug wars work. Prohibition worked. Turns out if the government says you can't do something and actually tries even a little bit to enforce it, rates of that thing happening fall off a cliff. It's called basic law and order.
Yeah. So Blake, should we bring back prohibition?
I don't know if we should, but I do like the point about heroin there at the end, which is just, I think Ross Douthat of the New York Times, had an article. Oh, this must have been a decade ago by now. I'm old. He made a great point, which is, alcohol is bad. If we were to pick, if we were setting our society from a blank slate and we were like, what should we legalize? Even if we were picking among the drugs that exist, we probably wouldn't pick alcohol as the one to have exist because it's addictive, it's harmful, has all these big problems. But it is, it's been around a long time, has a lot of cultural legacy. It would be difficult to completely stamp it out. But you can have this understanding of recognizing how harmful it is. Maybe it's the only one we should have be legal, and everything else we should just keep banned and not let it get normalized. Because what is really making alcohol worse these days, as he pointed out, is not just that people drink a lot, but it's that now you're crushing your prescription drugs into your alcoholic drink.
That's what I'm saying. That
it's piling up.
It's the combination of pharmacological agents. You have another point to make.
No one's on one drug. Everyone who's on any drugs is on like 10 of them, and they just go totally loopy. Now, the argument in favor of prohibition, I would say, is, as you pointed out, anyone who does drink drinks too much. It is an industry that it's kind of like gambling, I would say. It is fundamentally dependent on the addict to make it as an industry. Mm-hmm. That something like 15% of drinkers do 80% of the drinking, the old Pareto principle. And within, that 15%, it's like 5% of people who are alcoholics and 1% who are just drinking themselves to death. And the amount of alcohol that those people drink is like truly staggering and kind of horrifying because it does kill you over time.
The industry calls those people whales.
Whales.
Really and gross stuff.
It's a lot like a lot of industries are like this, like mobile games. Mobile games are all designed to be addictive so that you can hook a tiny handful of people who will blow thousands of dollars on this. Casinos are designed to rope in people who blow their entire entire social security check every single month on the slot machines. And I think it's valid to ask, is it really licit for us to sanction industries whose entire existence is dependent on people who are addicted to it?
Yeah. And so look, I mean, first of all, prohibition will happen in our lifetime. And I'm not even saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's interesting. And I mean, that's where I also push back, where someone's like, what, are you going to ban alcohol? I'm like, well, interesting. If you're going to start from base zero, to your point, you have 2,500 alcohol poisoned deaths a year. You have tens of thousands of auto-related fatalities, serious injuries, or deaths every single year. You have kidney issues. You have obesity issues. Not to mention, ask any cop, and the data supports this, any crime after 10 p.m., 80% of them have drugs or alcohol involved, like 80%, right? Domestic abuse, gang fights, murders, rape, all that sort of stuff. And so you combine all that together and you say, does the substance increase the virtue of the society? And the answer is, of course not. Now, you could do it in moderation. And look, the Bible does not explicitly say you shouldn't drink, but there are repeated warnings against drunkenness. And the wine that in Jesus' time was way more watered down than the wine in our time. There's all sorts of things. But is it virtuous, Sarab?
No. And ultimately, civilization and specifically Republican government requires citizens that are capable of reasoning. And this drug, like any other drug, heavily erodes people's ability to reason. Just to put some numbers on the consumption,
that's exactly
in the
right.
United States, if you are any of the six first deciles of alcohol consumption, that is to say the bottom 60% of the population, you functionally don't drink at all, less than one drink per week. The seventh decile, you get to 2.17 drinks per week. The eighth decile, you get to 6.25 drinks a week. So, you know, one glass of wine at night.
Let's bring that chart up on the computer screen here. I've got it here.
And then the ninth decile, you're at 15.28 drinks a week. That is to say two, maybe three drinks every night of the week. And then the top decile is 73.85. So 10% of Americans consume an average of 73.85 drinks a week. And imagine what our society would look like, how it might look different if that weren't happening.
And that's how much? 73 across the top 10%. So now imagine the top five, the top one, like top 1%. You're telling me that's people who just only drink.
Yeah. 30 million people
are drinking almost 75 drinks a week.
And 90% of them run our politics, our government, and our finance. Jack, you
and they're all in
make,
D.C.
Well, not all of
them.
No,
just a lot. Yeah, high percentage. Look, I'll just throw this out there because I always do. Sobriety works. If anybody out there is considering it, if you're thinking about it, if you're anywhere near, I don't care if you've tried it before and it hasn't worked, feel free to reach out. I always make myself available for anybody who wants to talk.
Yeah, and look, I'm not trying to be like overly moralizing here. It's not as if I've never had a drink. It's been a long time since I have. But seeing a couple things. The people that are undisciplined with alcohol live in perpetual suffering. The people that are undisciplined with alcohol, they go from rolling scandal to rolling issue. And if someone says they're disciplined with alcohol, I've seen it very rarely, very rarely. It's almost always abused because it happens like that. It happens very quickly. A man who drinks forgets the law, as it says in Proverbs. So, Rob.
Well, my bias on this is particularly funny because anyone who knows me or even follows me on social media will see that I'm really into craft cocktails. Like, I love making nice cocktails for my friends. And I think that, like anything, if you enjoy it, sustain your ability to enjoy it in the long term by making sure you put an extraordinary premium on moderation. And I'll say it to the young conservatives that listen to you, Charlie, that listen to you, Jack, that listen to you, Blake, like, be willing to speak into your friends' lives about this, because there is so much social pressure to just drink yourself into a stupor every night of your 20s and chill out when I'm in my 30s. God knows how much we're frying people's brains doing that.
It does poison your brain, 100%. Yeah. It's proven.
And so I would just encourage people that, look, if you want alcohol to be a small, moderate part of your life, that doesn't start when you turn 35. It starts the day you have your first drink.
It's a depressant. And I'll say this, Jack, you and I would agree. It's also a competitive edge. You don't drink, you get up earlier, you have no hangovers, you're able to allow them for more calories. And every single person that I see that has stopped drinking, their career explodes. Mm-hmm. Tucker Carlson, right? You, Jack. I mean, I see it across the board. I'm not trying to moralize. I'm not trying to judge people. But yeah, go ahead.
I have had people within the movement, and this is maybe why I didn't come down so forcefully when you asked me the question originally, because I'm not going to say these names publicly, but I have had people that we all know who are huge names in the movement just in the last 12 months reach out to me person after person after person saying, hey, man, I just want to let you know I haven't had a drink in 5 months. Hey, man, I just want to let you know I haven't had a drink in whatever period of time it's been. I feel great. It feels good. It's not like an anti-alcohol thing. I think it's just more like people are paying attention to their health more. They're listening to Huberman more. Charlie, I know you're a big Huberman guy.
I love Huberman. It's amazing.
That, you know, they're thinking about the alcohol's effect on your brain. And by the way, his episode on alcohol, if you just want to learn the neuroscience behind that, it ain't pretty. It ain't pretty.
The distillery industry would not be happy with Huberman's truth there. Just do your research, everybody. And by the way, if you're dealing with depression and anxiety, alcohol does not help. It is a depressant. It is neurologically proven to increase depression, increase suicidal ideation. Okay, let's get to the final topic of the night, which is one of my favorite stories. It's almost too good to be true. Blake, it came from you. Walk us through it. And Sarab, you have time?
Yeah.
You have 10 minutes? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Ish? Okay,
so,
Blake.
This all came up. A friend of mine who's in the DeSantis camp, which is fine. But I do think he's in a little bit of denial about Ron's overall prospects for winning the nomination. And he was like, look, Blake.
Do we have the poll? We got to be able to.
We'll bring it up here. Okay, we have to build it up. He's like, Blake, there's new polls, and they show Ron, you know, he's actually ahead of Trump in New Hampshire. And he sent it to me, and I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then I started taking a look, and there were a few other polls, and I don't have the New Hampshire one, unfortunately, because I'm not logged into Twitter on my thing right now, but I do have their poll for
you got to read it off.
Iowa. Their poll for Iowa. Actually, let's go for their national poll.
Yes.
This poll is a national Republican primary poll. First place, it says Ron DeSantis, 47%. You put 100 Republicans in a room, 47 of them are pulling the lever for Ron. Second place, Vivek Ramaswamy, 23%. Third place at 15%, Donald Trump. No, Chris Christie. And then at 10%, Donald Trump. 10% Republican voters, according to this poll, are ready to vote for Trump. And they have another poll. We've got it up on the screen here. Can we zoom in a bit? There we go. Yeah, there we go. And who produced this poll for us to read it? It is none other than an outfit named Ron Polling Incorporated.
So I had this texted to me from multiple people, one of them a DeSantis shill who just, you know, is as delusional as a trans activist, right? Like out of control. And they're like, we're gaining steam. And I was like, okay, who conduct? By the way, you know what the tell? They said that they had 5,000 respondents.
Yeah, 5,600.
No way you'll get 5,000 respondents in an Emerson Siena poll before a general election in Pennsylvania, like 5,000 respondents. And so, Jack, this thing started to travel on Twitter, and DeSantis shills on Twitter were like, we got him. Trump's in fourth place, according to Ron Polling.
So what's really going on here is this is, without a doubt, the greatest polling firm in contemporary America, 21st century America, Ron Polling. And look, I say this as a guy. Look, people know I'm a Trump guy, and I feel dejected when I look at these numbers. But I'm aware of Ron Polling's fantastic track record, their history. And I would go so far as to say they are the gold standard in the industry. We must always trust Ron Polling, and really only trust Ron Polling for all polling endeavors going forward.
Here's another great one. I've got their 20. You can look at it here. Their 2024 Iowa Republican primary poll. They usually would say caucus poll in polls, but they're ahead of the curve. And I think, you know, okay, we've got DeSantis in first again, then Vivek, then Christie again. Trump's at 12.
Christie in Iowa.
But the best part is Chuck Grassley is polling at 5%.
Wow.
And Chuck Grassley's not running for president.
Best polling company ranked by People magazine. You know.
What is the best part about this is people believed it.
Well, why wouldn't you? They're the gold standard.
Look, I'm unaffiliated in the presidential primary. I want a great Republican president to get elected and help staff them with the best people we have to make sure that we actually implement the agenda that the people keep voting for. However, what I've said to my friends on the DeSantis campaign or affiliated with it for a long time is it is entirely reasonable for Ron DeSantis and his supporters to think that he should be president of the United States, but you have to operate in reality, like at the end of the day. And so if you're operating in fantasy land where there is a set of facts where Trump is in fourth in Iowa and fourth in New Hampshire, that's fine. I'm just not going to come to your imaginary fantasy land with you. You're welcome to enjoy your treehouse where this is the reality, but acknowledging what's actually going on in the electorate might help you give better advice to your candidate who honestly deserves better advice than he's often getting.
Are you some kind of Ron Polling denier right now? Is that what's going on? You're just denying?
Yeah. I'm a Ron
denying
Polling
the efficacy
truther.
Of Ron Polling?
Here's the thing. This is the Ron after, Polling truth we got after over this here. Video, it's entirely conceivable that Ron DeSantis' poll numbers skyrocketed. Play cut 97.
Just here for the eggs.
And then you do like fry them sometimes or what do you do?
Where'd Christy go? You want one?
Okay.
Thank you.
Inside income and to help you guys at some point during all these prevails.
Sure.
I can do these too.
whatever consultant thought this was a good idea should be sent to Gitmo. Jack, you could probably arrange that. I mean, this, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have you make, put eggs in.
Feel the disantimentum. I mean, this is where, look, you have to understand that Ron Poling's methodology includes diverse sampling, rigorous data analysis, and a keen understanding of regional political dynamic. You might think that this video of Ron DeSantis not making eye contact with anyone, simply staring at hard-boiled eggs and you know, sticking them with little pencil sticks, little popsicle sticks, is wrong or something. But much like the Tibetan greeting of sticking your tongue out in Iowa, this is actually considered a regional and traditional bestowing of not only respect but blessing.
Yeah, if anyone questions Ron Poling, you're an election denier.
We will fight them.
Big Fanny Willis will indict you.
I will find you and fight you in real life at your house.
Okay, Blake, do we have something else we need to cover?
We just have the we're scuttling
final
the
thoughts, Rob. Tell us about American Moment, what you're doing. Give us a nice little plug here.
Sure. American Moment's job is to make sure that after we're done with this presidential food fight, that we actually get an administration full of the people that we need in order to implement the agenda that the American people keep voting for. Basically, we're trying to build up the legion of, you know, 15,000 or so people you need to actually run politics. These are the staffers that staff the congressmen that people keep electing. These are the 4,000 or so political appointments that every president gets to make. It's the other people in D.C., the policymaker, the policy entrepreneurs, the think tank people, et cetera. Basically, you need a couple thousand people in order to run the country. We don't have them right now. The ones we have are incompetent. The ones that are competent are parts of the establishment. It's American Moment's job to build up that population.
Yeah, so, I mean, do you think we're prepared if something miraculous happens and a Republican wins?
I think we're getting more so. Look, I can't do everything, but I think that there is a coalition of groups that are thinking heavily about these questions, that are putting in the work now. We're much more organized than we were prior to 2016. I can say that having looked at the history, even though I wasn't there. So I think we're poised to have a better answer to that question of personnel next time. But ultimately, there's only so much that the people who are already in politics can do. What we need, this is part of the reason I get so hopping mad when I see stuff like the 65 Project and what they're doing to President Trump's lawyers. What we need is people to step into the arena and say, I'm going to dedicate my life, or at least a portion of my career, to being a competent America First person who will help staff the next administration or staff these congressional offices. And the left is doing everything they can to make sure that it is as risky as possible to do that. That's okay. We'll still find brave people. But if you want to get involved, you can go to AmericanMoment.org.
And it's fair to say you guys are the based staffing arm of the conservative movement.
Look, we have a statement of priorities that goes through everything you could ask. It goes through how immigration has to be restricted, how our foreign policy has to be restrained, how we need to have protectionist trade policies, how the family is the bedrock of American society. So when it comes to those core issues that define the America First agenda, we are the only organization, as far as I've ever seen, that put it in as explicit terms. So I guess you could say that.
Very good. Jack, final thoughts before we send Sarab back to where he came from.
Sarab, you have to go back. Well, I just want to let everybody know that this T-shirt that I'm wearing is 20 years old. This is the Summer Sanitarium T-shirt. This is a bootleg that I bought in the parking lot outside of Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia, which no longer exists. This was Metallica, Linkin Park, and Limp Bizkit all at the same show.
Very good. And I do want to say, everyone support AmericanMoment.org. It is excellent and necessary. Blake, final thoughts. By the way, we're taking standing applications for the Blake Neff marriage carousel. Oh, get Blake Neff married. And Sarab, maybe, I don't know if you're married or dating anybody. We can have eggs. You're good. Okay. Not interested. So Blake Neff, top urgency. He shaved his beard. So it's this whole new dynamic. And in the least gay possible, I think you look great, Blake.
Final thoughts, we're going to cut aid to Ukraine and we're going to channel it towards opening a new Pizza Hut with only 80s and early 90s arcade games in every city in America. And it would be a better use of the money.
That's central planning at its best. Till next time, hoping we're not in federal prison or indicted by Fannie Willis. God bless you guys and keep committing thought crimes. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email us your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thank you so much for listening, and God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.
When I grow up, I want to work for a woke company, like super woke.
When I grow up,
I want to be hired based on what I look like
rather than my skills.
I want to be judged
by my political beliefs.
I want to get promoted
based on my chromosomes.
When I grow up,
I want to be offended
by my coworkers
and walk around the office
on eggshells
and have my words policed
by HR.
Words like
grandfather,
peanut gallery,
long time no see,
no can do.
When I grow up,
I want to be obsessed with emotional safety
and do workplace sensitivity training
all day long.
When I grow up, I want to climb the corporate ladder
just by following the crowd.
I want to be a conformist.
I want to weaponize my pronouns.
What are pronouns?
It's time to grow up and get back to work. Introducing the number one woke-free job board in America, RedBalloon.work.